But first this morning, how enemies become friends. The Munich Accord, Neville Chamberlain's pact with Hitler in 1938, is often cited as the example of wrong-headed diplomacy and appeasement. The lessons of the Munich Accord are writ large in the minds of many a diplomat and political leader. But what is the case, the worthy case, for seeking rapprochement between rival nations? Well, according to my first guest, there are numerous examples of nations replacing hostility with accord, and that this sort of diplomacy is a key to good foreign policy, and perhaps the nature of the opposing regime matters little when it really comes to seeking peace. Charles Kupchan is Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University, and he's Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He served on the National Security Council during the Clinton presidency and is the author of How Enemies Become Friends. He believes it's all about that golden word, accommodation, and concessions between former rivals. Here's Charles Kupchan.
Well, one of the findings in the book that I was surprised by was the degree to which economic interdependence, trade, investment doesn't matter as much as commonly thought. And when I went and looked at 20 cases where countries that were longstanding rivals tried to find their way to friendship, I found that it was all about diplomacy, about concessions, about accommodation, about security, borders, these sorts of things. And then toward the end, economics kicks in, trade and investment kicks in. But I think it tends to be exaggerated in the public mind. Peace initially is about diplomacy, and only later is it about commercial interdependence.
Very interesting. And you say that long-standing rivalries can thaw as a result of very good diplomacy, and mutual accommodation, this is this word, that this verb, accommodate, which is very interesting, not coercive intimidation. Can you give us a couple of significant examples of this?
Sure. Well, going back to where you started the program, you mentioned Munich and appeasement. And unfortunately, the history of the onset of World War II gave accommodation a bad name, because Chamberlain was wrong to appease Hitler, and had he not, perhaps World War II might not have happened. But there are many cases in history in which one country accommodates another one as a way of sending a signal of benign intent. So one of the larger cases in the book is U.S. and U.K. in the 1890s. After about a century of struggle, including the War of Independence and then the War of 1812 and then decades of hostility, peace suddenly breaks out. And it breaks out initially because the British, who feel overextended, they have too many imperial commitments, and they say to themselves, we need to turn one of our enemies into a friend. They decide that the U.S. is the best possible case, and they start accommodating on borders, on sea presence, naval presence in the Western Atlantic, on questions of fishing rights. And they succeed in saying to the Americans and to the Congress, we don't want to be in geopolitical rivalry with you anymore. And the U.S. then responds in kind. And it's that mutual exchange that gets the ball rolling.
So does it tend to follow, Charles, one or other country starting to feel overextended and to feel that this game is just not worth it? In other words, does it have to come from a perceived position of upcoming weakness?
In all the cases I look at, there is some kind of strategic imperative. Oftentimes it is an environment, a geopolitical environment that is too threatening. Sometimes the strategic imperative comes from within. For example, in Brazil in 1978-79, the security apparatus was being overtaken by hardliners. And the moderates in the military junta said, we need to back away from competition with Argentina. Otherwise, the country is going to be taken over by the hardliners. In the case of Indonesia, after Suharto took control from Sukarno, he needed to pull Indonesia out of an economic tailspin. And he did that by backing away from confrontation with Malaysia, thereby getting the U.S. and the international financial institutions to drop sanctions. So there is a sort of impetus in each case that gets one country to make a gesture of goodwill to the other. And when that gesture is reciprocated, then the two begin to walk together.
And how do you pull this off politically, internally? Because obviously the people have become used to a certain hostility, possibly even defined themselves by it, and then suddenly you change.
In every case, there are domestic dangers, domestic opposition to accommodating an adversary. There are always nationalists waiting in the wing to take down a leader who tries to befriend a long-running adversary. So, for example, right now, President Obama is trying to build a new relationship with Russia. He's trying to reach out to Syria, to Cuba, and even to Iran. And I would go so far to say that he has a greater obstacle at home in the United States than he does abroad in terms of the leaders he's trying to cooperate with. And that's because Congress, especially the Senate, may not be ready to sign off on arms control with the Russians. Iran is not behaving in a way that wins congressional goodwill. And so not only do the leaders that pursue rapprochement need to be deft diplomats, they need to be very fleet-footed at home because they need to know how to tap dance around the domestic opponents that are looking for an opportunity to bring them down for being too soft.
Charles Kupchan is our guest on Saturday Extra, Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University, with his interesting new book, How Enemies Become Friends, The Sources of Stable Peace. Going back to that thought we had earlier about negotiating with Hitler, is it simply immoral to negotiate with some partners, even in the cause of a stable peace?
I think it depends on the intentions of the partner. And in the case of Hitler, I think it's safe to say that it was easy from 1933, 1934, onwards up to the Anschluss, invasion of Austria, Poland, that this was not a guy that was going to be open to the reciprocal exchange of concessions. And so when you think you're dealing with that kind of aggressor, you don't want to try rapprochement because it will be exploited. But in many other cases, it's unclear what the intentions of the other side are. And that's why at the beginning you can try probes. You can let down your guard only so far to see if the other side will reciprocate. And so in those early stages, one has to proceed carefully because there are instances in which offers of conciliation are rejected. And when that happens, you raise your guard and you go back to being competitors. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't try. It just means that when you reach out to a Syria or a Cuba or a Russia, you do so with eyes wide open that it might not work.
I was thinking of reaching out to an Iran, because this is obviously, there are some big elephants in the room in this discussion. One's the Taliban and one's Iran. Yeah. With an Iran, with the head of Ahmadinejad, who insists on making outrageous statements about Israel. Now, so you're saying that it is still worth considering sitting down with someone who doesn't desist from that type of rhetoric?
Well, Ahmadinejad, I would say, is in a class of his own. And the stuff that comes out of his mouth and the policies that he pursues are over the line. But he is not fully in control. There is a very fluid situation within Iran. And that's why I think it makes sense to keep the door open to diplomacy even while moving toward sanctions. And I would also add, and this is another important finding of the book, that I think we sometimes overrate the ability of democracies to get to peace and underrate the ability of non-democracies to be cooperative partners. Because in general, we look out at the world and we see Australia and we see New Zealand and we see Germany. We say, okay, those are democracies. We can work with them. And then we see a country like China or we see a country like Cuba and we say, well, not democracies. But I found that even countries that are not very nice at home can be cooperative and reliable partners in their foreign policy. That doesn't mean that they always will be, But it means that we should be careful about putting non-democracies in a box and assuming that they are troublemakers instead of seeing whether we will be able to work with them to common ends.
You do suggest that over the long run, working with, as you put it, recalcitrant autocrats, now that's not Iran and that's not the Taliban, but nevertheless, I get your point,
right,
may undermine
right.
them far more effectively than containment and confrontation.
One of the refrains of the right here in the U.S. when Obama says, I'm going to, you know, talk to the Iranians or talk to the Cubans is, no, you must change the regime. They must go. Don't talk to them. Coerce them into submission. But historically speaking, oftentimes engagement is a better way to get rid of them than coercion. And that's because when you engage, when you succeed in moving the relationship to a more cooperative footing, those leaders are no longer able to legitimate themselves through rallying around the nationalist cause. So, for example, in Brazil and Argentina, rapprochement started when both countries were run by military juntas. But when the competition began to de-escalate, democratization broke out.
Just quickly, who would you accommodate now? Or where would you start that process, Charles, if you were pulling the strings?
Well, you know, I think that Obama, precisely because he's having a tough time, needs a victory. And of these various countries that he is engaging right now, I would say that Russia is the most likely to bear fruit. There is a lot of common interest on Iran and Afghanistan and the Middle East. So I think I would focus American diplomacy on trying to get the reset button pushed with the Russians and then use that as an example to opponents and to Congress to say, look, I told you so, talking to adversaries can lead to good outcomes.
Charles Kupchan, it's been a great pleasure to have you join us on Saturday Extra. Thank you for your time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And Charles Kupchan is Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University. He's also Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and his book, How Enemies Become Friends, The Sources of Stable Peace, is a Princeton University publication.